Bay, Italy, and apart from Giovanna, who was in Berlin on sabbatical, she did not have a single Roman friend. In the morning she made espresso and heated up milk and spread jam on squares of packaged toast, and by 8 she was at Giovanna's desk, colonized now with a ferment of Hema's books, her notebooks, her laptop, her Latin grammar and dictionary. In spite of the hundreds of things she might be doing or seeing in the city, until 1 o'clock each day, she maintained this routine. This was her anchor. This had been her anchor for years. She was a professor now, her dissertation on Lucretius a bound, published, quietly praised thing. And yet it was the aspect of her job that required her to sit for hours alone at a desk that still fulfilled her more than anything. Since 8th grade, reading Latin had been an addiction, every line a puzzle to coax into meaning. The knowledge she'd slowly accumulated, the ancient words and declensions and syntax that dwelled in her brain, felt sacred, enabling her to bring a dead world to life. The Etruscans were her focus now. A few months ago, she had attended a lecture in Boston about Etruscan references in Virgil. And this had ushered her headlong into that mysterious civilization prior to Rome, people who had possibly wandered from Asia Minor to central Italy and flourished for 4 centuries, who had ruled Rome for 100 years before turning obsolete. Their literature was non-existent, their language obscure, their primary legacy was tombs and the things that were put in them, jewels, pottery, weapons to accompany the dead. She was learning about the haruspices, augurs who interpreted the will of the gods through the entrails of animals, lightning bolts, dreams of pregnant women, flights of birds. She wanted to put a seminar together when she returned to Wellesley, about Etruscan influence in Roman antiquity, and possibly, based on her research, a proposal for a second book. She had gone to the Vatican to see the Etruscan collection at the Gregorian Museum, and also to the Villa Giulia. She was combing through Cicero and Seneca, Livy and Pliny, reading fragments of the occultist senator Nigidius Figulus, typing notes into her laptop, marking up the many books she read. And so Hema had not yet called anyone, not contacted any of Giovanna's friends so that they could meet her for a coffee or drive her out to Tivoli or to Ostia, as Giovanna assured her they would. She was content to spend the days alone, working, reading, and then having lunch by the portico. In the afternoons, she wandered in and out of churches along dark, cramped streets that opened into enormous, light-filled squares. She walked everywhere, almost never resorting to a bus or the metro. In the evening, she retreated, preparing dinner at home, simple meals she ate while watching Italian television. It felt wrong to be out alone at night, more awkward to sit by herself at dinner than lunch. During her years with Julian, even when she was by herself, men had sensed that her heart was taken, that she would not pause to consider them, as if she were a passing taxi with its off-duty light on. But now, though she was engaged, she was aware of the Roman men who looked at her, sometimes called out. And though she was flattered by their attention, it reminded her that her heart did not belong to Naveen in the same way. Saturday mornings, instead of working, she would go to the Campo dei Fiori, watching the stylish mothers in their high heels and jewels and quilted jackets pushing strollers and buying vegetables by the kilo. These women, with their rich, loose tangles of hair, their sunglasses concealing no wrinkles, were younger than Hema, but she felt inexperienced in their company, innocent of the responsibilities of rearing children and running a household and haggling flirtatiously with vegetable vendors. She had grown used to this feeling over the years with Julian, her position as the other woman, which had felt so sophisticated when their affair began, was actually a holding pen that kept her from growing up. She had denied herself the pleasure of openly sharing life with the person she loved, denied herself even the possibility of thinking about children. But Naveen had changed that too. They were both aware of her age, and as soon as they were married, Naveen told her, he was eager to begin a family. One day after lunch, feeling energetic, she walked all the way to Piazza del Popolo, and then over to Villa Giulia for another visit. In the museum, she was moved once again by the ancient cups and spoons still intact that had once touched people's lips, the fibulae that had fastened their clothes, the thin wands with which they had applied perfume to their skin. But this time, looking at the giant sarcophagus of the bride and groom enclosed in a box of glass, she found herself in tears. She couldn't help but think of Naveen. Like the young, smiling couple sitting affectionately on top of a shared casket, there was something dead about the marriage she was about to enter into. And though she knew it had every chance, over the years, of coming to life, on her way home, in the yellow light of evening, she was conscious only of its deadness. She shopped for her dinner in an alimentari on Via dei Giubinari, and now she carried a bag containing lettuce, a box of spaghetti, and mushrooms and cream to turn into a sauce. She walked through the studded doorway of Giovanna's building, past a window like a ticket booth, where one of two porters greeted her each day as she left and returned. In the courtyard, a stone lion continually poured water from his mouth, and then up the stone steps, unlit, unyielding beneath her tired feet, three generous flights that felt like 10. In the long hallway of Giovanna's apartment, she saw the answering machine blinking. She played back the tape. It was not Naveen's voice, but a friend of Giovanna's. Normally, these friends left messages in Italian that Giovanna retrieved from Berlin. But this message in English was for Hema. It was a person named Edo, a name she recognized from Giovanna's list of people to call. For weeks, Edo said in his message, he had been expecting Hema to get in touch. Was everything all right? He sounded kind and genuinely distressed enough for Hema to return the call. She assured Edo that all was well, and because she had no other excuse, she accepted his invitation to have lunch with him and his wife the following Sunday.
Edo's wife Paola was a photo editor at L'Espresso, but Kaushik had met her in a resort town on the Israeli coast, where they'd both gone to cover the bombing of a hotel banquet hall, the victims about to begin their Passover meal. It was only rarely that he worked in Italy. The odd photo essay about Senegalese immigrants in Brescia, or shots of the 19 caskets containing the soldiers in Iraq being carried past the Colosseum. For most of the past 5 years, Rome had simply been a place from which to get to where he needed to go, and if he looked back at his pocket calendars, each with their 365 sky blue pages, and counted the days, he could have confirmed that most of them had been spent taking pictures in Gaza and the West Bank. His life as a photojournalist had begun nearly 20 years ago. He was wandering through Latin America in 1987, living off the money his father gave him after he graduated from college. He'd gone with his friend Douglas, and they began in Tijuana, hoping to end up in Patagonia. They spent a few months in Mexico working their way south through Guatemala and then into El Salvador. And it was there that Douglas decided he'd had enough of Central America, enough of being harassed for looking so obviously American, and bought a ticket to Madrid. Like the Mexicans and Guatemalans, the Salvadorans were never sure what to make of Kaushik. Not the soldiers who patrolled the streets with guns nearly as big as their bodies, not the children who posed eagerly for pictures when they saw him with his camera. He began to explore the country alone, a country that was smaller, he'd read in his guidebook, than Massachusetts. He took pictures of the volcano that loomed west of the capital, buildings pocked by bullets and cracked in half by the earthquake earlier that year. He'd never been in a place so obviously at war with itself. He'd understood in Guatemala that the guerrillas were active, gathered from other backpackers that there were parts of the country to avoid. An overnight bus he and Douglas took to Tikal was stopped, and they and the rest of the passengers were ordered to step out and show their passports. Flashlights aimed at their faces by a group of drunken checkpoint guards. One of the guards asked to see Douglas's wallet, took the cash, and tossed the wallet back in Douglas's face. In Guatemala, that had been the worst of it. But in El Salvador, things were more violent, more gruesome, the tourists more scarce. In Santa Ana, Kaushik befriended a Dutch journalist named Espen and began to travel around, absorbing the history of the conflict, the stories Espen told him of the death squads, decapitated bodies strewn on the highways, teenagers hanging from trees with fingernails missing and thumbs tied behind their backs. With Espen, he watched Air Force planes dropping bombs at night on FMLN territory, went to visit a refugee camp across the Honduran border. He absorbed the fear of the place and of its people, grew used to the sound of machine gun fire, accepted, as everyone did, the fact that he could at any moment, anywhere, crossing a road or asleep at night, be killed. But he'd never felt afraid back then for himself. While sitting with Espen one afternoon eating lunch in a village outside Morazan, The table began to shake, dark stew spilling from bowls. By then he'd grown used to occasional tremors, the earth's violence yielding a moment's pause. They picked up their spoons, continued eating, but then people began exclaiming, running past them through the small square. He and Espen leapt up, following the crowd, thinking perhaps a building had fallen, but the commotion had nothing to do with the tremors. They turned a corner to see a young man lying on the street. He'd been shot in the head, blood pouring like a slowly widening river away from his skull, but not a speck of blood or even dirt, Kaushik still remembered, staining his tan shirt and trousers. He was curled on the pavement, eyes closed as if napping, the faintest sound escaping from his throat, a cheap gold watch telling the time on his wrist. A group of people gathered around the body calling for a doctor, while a young woman, a wife, or a girlfriend in a pink sleeveless blouse sat on the ground weeping with her fist in her mouth. Kaushik's camera was around his neck as usual, and Espen told him to take a picture. He did not have a long lens with him, had to get in close, expecting at each step for someone in the group to obstruct him, curse at him, shoo him away. But no one paid attention, and so he crept forward and lifted the camera to his face. When he thought back to that afternoon, he remembered that his hands were shaking, but that otherwise he felt untouched by the situation, unmoved once he was behind the camera, shooting to the end of the roll. When he was finished, the calls for a doctor had stopped. The man was dead. Kaushik was the only person to document what had happened, and though he had not saved the man's life, he'd felt useful, aware that he had done something to mitigate the crime. Still, he never believed that the pictures would be published until Espen sent them to the right people. A week later, one ran in a Catholic newspaper published out of Amsterdam. He received a small check. And then, when the photo was picked up by a European news magazine, a larger one. And so, he began taking pictures for a living. At first, he simply woke up and followed the news, sticking close to Espen, staying in El Salvador through the elections, the transportation strike, the killing of the 6 Jesuit priests and their housekeepers. He photographed bodies with faces smashed and throats slit, and penises hacked from between their legs, handing the images over to a human rights agency so that relatives could attempt to identify the disappeared. Thanks to a connection of Espen's, he was hired as a stringer for AP, and so he remained in Latin America, first in Mexico, then Buenos Aires, working for wire services and English language papers. When he was 30, he was hired by the New York Times, and they sent him to Africa and then to the Middle East. He could no longer remember all the corpses he'd photographed, their faces bloated, their mouths stuffed with dirt, their vacant eyes reflecting passing clouds over their heads. The demands of the job allowed him permanently to avoid the United States. Occasional trips to New York to meet with an editor, to pick up equipment. This was the extent of his time in America. And there were trips when he'd not bothered to tell his father he was in the country, when he'd avoided the miserable day trip to Massachusetts to see his father's new life, though by now, that life had surpassed in years the old. His father was in his 70s now, living off a generous pension and devoting most of his time to golf. From sporadic emails, Kaushik learned that Rupa, the older of the girls, had married an American named Peter and taught art to elementary school students in Colorado. He had received an invitation to the wedding, but thanks to his work, his excuse for so many things, he had not gone. The little one, Pew, was in medical school at Tufts, and yet, also thanks to his work, Kaushik continued to wash up on his father's doorstep in the form of his photo credit in one of the news magazines his father read, announcing that he was alive, indicating where he'd been and what he'd seen. He kept a place in Trastevere, a tiny apartment off Piazza di San Cosimato with a generous terrace where between assignments he recovered. A woman had brought Kaushik to Italy. Until Franca, he had preferred Latin America to Europe, and even now the Spanish he had learned all those years ago got in the way of his serviceable Italian. Franca had convinced him to follow her back to Milan. She came from a family of minor nobility. Her heart-shaped face and deep-set gray eyes speaking for a refinement she had not been able to hide when he first met her working for a relief agency in Cameroon. For years he had drifted across the globe without making meaningful ties, and suddenly he was sharing an apartment with Franca, driving out to Bergamo on Sundays to eat polenta and roasted rabbit at her nonna's home, aware that her grandmother, who who had spent years hand-stitching and embroidering a trousseau of nightgowns and bed jackets for Franca, approved of him. It had ended bitterly. Though at the time, he could never come up with a reason not to, he could not bring himself to propose. She had not taken hold of him. He could see now that that was the problem. And so he left the tears and fury in Milan and took the train down to Rome. At first, he thought he'd stay a week to see a little bit of the city, then move back to Buenos Aires. But the second Intifada drew him back to the Middle East, and he stayed on in Europe, never telling Franca that he was living in her country, never once running into her. He remembered Rome, of course, from the only other time he'd gone there, on the way back from Bombay to Massachusetts with his parents. His mother was dying, but at the time, apart from her thinness, there had been no signs. She had just turned 40, Kaushik's age on his next birthday. He remembered the look of the hotel where they stayed, the marble steps they would ascend to go to the breakfast room, the strong shaft of light that poured through the dome of the Pantheon, and the glances of admiration the waiters could not conceal as his mother perused a menu. He remembered walking along the Janiculum and seeing clusters of swallows like giant thumbprints swiping the sky. And he had returned like a pilgrim to those places, recalled that the hotel was close to the Spanish steps, and managed to find it somehow. Last year his father and Chitra had visited him in Rome, spending 4 days on their way to Calcutta. He had obliged reserving a room for them at the Hotel Dingleterra and taking them everywhere. He stood in line with them to see the Colosseum and walked with them through the Forum. He took pictures of their stay, handing his father the rolls of film before they left as if it had been any other job. He ordered Chitra tea with milk in every restaurant, every cafe, because she did not like the taste of Italian coffee. But they had left no dent on the place, and he never thought of their presence on the streets of Rome as he continued to think now and again of his mother's. It was in the course of those days with his father and Chitra that a faint gray speck, smaller than the head of a pin, began floating across his left eye. He first noticed it the afternoon they went to Testaccio, his father wanting to visit Keats' grave. In the lush grounds of the Protestant cemetery, Kaushik had thought that a gnat was circling his head, and he kept swatting at it, putting out his fingers trying to flick it away. But the speck continued to accompany him wherever he went, quietly tormenting him, and he realized it was within him, that it was not possible to remove it or make it stop. An optometrist explained that it was caused by vitreous gel clumping and pulling away from the wall of his eye, that it was a harmless symptom of getting older. He was told he would grow used to it, and he had more or less not bothered these days unless he were in a bright room with white walls or outside without his sunglasses. It did not affect his driving or his picture-taking, and yet it felt like an invasion of the part of his body, the physical sense that was most precious, something that betrayed him and also refused to abandon him. On Sunday, he set out in his Fiat for Edo and Paula's, in a suburb south of the city. The thought of leaving the city, the streets he now navigated with ease, made him melancholy. For he was leaving. In the new year, he would be gone. A position as a photo editor for an international news magazine had opened up in Hong Kong, and he had accepted. Apart from a few visits to Tokyo, he knew little of East Asia. It would be the first time in his life that a job would mean waking up and going to the same place each day, the first time he would have an office, a desk, an assistant to schedule his appointments and take his calls. The first time he would not wake up unprepared until he was chasing after it for what the day would bring. In that sense, he would taste a version of the professional life his father had maintained for decades. He imagined he would hate it. Paola told him he was making a mistake, warning him that it was death to the photographer, that since becoming an editor, she hadn't taken a decent picture. The money would be better, but that wasn't what had attracted Kaushik. It was his need for a different life that was taking him to Asia. The promise, for the next few years at least, that he would be still. The magazine was paying for his move, but apart from the Fiat which he had already arranged to sell to a friend, he owned little. It was nothing like the times he moved with his parents, those two colossal upheavals he had experienced as a boy, first leaving America, then returning 7 years later. The furniture and paintings and tea sets his mother thought she could not live without, following them slowly both times on cargo ships. His mother had set up households again and again in her life. It didn't matter where she was in the world or whether or not she was dying. She had always given everything to make her homes beautiful, always drawn strength from her things, her walls. But Kaushik never fully trusted the places he'd lived, never turned to them for refuge. From childhood, he realized now he was always happiest to be outside, away from the private detritus of life. That was the first thing he'd loved about taking pictures. It had gotten him out of the house. His earliest memories of Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he'd been born, were all outdoors. A chain-link fence matted with forsythia. The herringbone pattern of bricks on a sidewalk. His mother's voice calling his name as he ran across the common. He was reminded of his family's moves every time he visited another refugee camp, every time he watched a family combing through rubble for their possessions. In the end, that was life. A few plates, a favorite comb, a pair of slippers, a child's string of beads. He wanted to believe that he was different, that in 10 minutes he could be on his way to anywhere in the world. But he knew that it was impossible, wherever he landed, not to form attachments. He would miss the short-tinted wine glasses in his Trastevere cupboards, the shrinking trapezoid of sunlight cast on his bed in the afternoons. And he knew that in his own way, with his camera, he was dependent on the material world, stealing from it, hoarding it, unwilling to let it go. The move to Asia was official now. His landlord, the owner of the gelateria on the corner, had found a new tenant. And just yesterday, he had booked his ticket, arranging for a layover in Thailand where he planned to spend the last week of December before continuing on to Hong Kong. Edo liked to cook, specializing in the cuisine of his native Cremona. Kaushik imagined a gathering like all the others Edo and Paula liked to organize, an international crowd of journalists and photographers and academics, always 3 or 4 languages spoken at the table. Today, Paula had mentioned an American novelist was coming, someone homesick for Thanksgiving and bringing in apple pie. There would also be an Indian woman, Paula said, a scholar, a friend of a friend of Edo's. He pictured someone middle-aged in spectacles and a sari, an archaeologist like Edo. He had so little to do with India. He had not gone back since the year his mother died, had never gone there for work. As a photographer, his origins were irrelevant. And yet, in Rome, in all of Europe, he was always regarded as an Indian first. A few blocks from Edo and Paula's, he parked the car and got out. The neighborhood was spectacular in its own way. Broad avenues lined with cypress, concrete post-war buildings with glass entrances, and protruding balconies stacked one on top of the next. He realized he would probably not return here before leaving Italy, wanted to take a picture, but he had left his camera at home. Paula and Edo lived on a high floor in an airy apartment overlooking a park. Turning onto their street, Kaushik noticed a woman standing on the sidewalk, long hair concealing her face, staring down at a map. "Signorina, dove deve andare?" he asked. The woman looked up confused and realized, in spite of her dark hair and fitted leather coat, that she was not Italian, that in fact, she was Indian. That he needn't have used the polite form in addressing her, that her face was one he'd known.
From the moment they arrived at Paolo and Edo's, it was assumed by the other guests that they were old friends. One of the guests had even assumed they were lovers, asking how long they had been together, how they had met. "Our parents," Kaushik had said lightly, but Hema thought back, saddened by those two simple words. She was aware that he had not corrected the guest's assumption, aware, too, of the way he looked at her across the table during lunch, surprised by the allure that had come to her late. He looked the same to her, that was the astonishing thing, the sharp-faced boy who had stepped reluctantly into her parents' home. Only the eyes appeared tired, the skin surrounding them now darker, faintly bruised. He was dressed like an Italian, wearing jeans and a thin black pullover, brown and white sneakers with Velcro straps. She still remembered her first impression of him, a quiet teenager in a jacket and tie, refusing her mother's food. She remembered the ridiculous attraction she had felt that night when she was 13 years old, and that she had secretly nurtured during the weeks they lived together. It was as if no time had passed. After lunch, he drove her back, inviting her to his place in a quiet neighborhood where laundry hung between apricot-colored houses and old men sat in folding chairs on the streets. The men watched silently as Kaushik unlocked the bolts and Hema waited at his side. it was unquestioned that they would not part yet. Unquestioned that though they had not seen or thought of each other in decades, not sought each other out, something precious had been stumbled upon, a newborn connection that could not be left unattended, that demanded every particle of their care. The building was nothing like Giovanna's, the door easily overlooked, an enclosed staircase leading directly into a small world. The apartment was a room and a bathroom and a two-burner stove. He led her to the terrace to see the neighboring rooftops, the Romanesque bell tower of the church on the piazza. "You're that way," he said, putting his hands lightly on her shoulders, orienting her. He told her that he'd returned to Rome recently, that a week before he'd been in Ramallah, covering Arafat's funeral. 20,000 people had turned up, he said, scaling walls and tearing down barbed wire for a glimpse of the coffin. They remained on the terrace, talking into the evening. She told him about college and graduate school, learning that during her first year at Bryn Mawr, he'd been close by, at Swarthmore. She told him about her years in New York, getting her PhD, her job at Wellesley. And while she mentioned nothing about Julian, that long involvement, enough to make her feel at times like a divorced woman, was rendered meaningless in the official chronicle of her past. Eventually she told him that she was going to marry Naveen. Koshik leaned toward her, across the small metal table where they were sitting. They had long ago digested Edo's pumpkin tortelli and bolito misto with mostarda, their heads clear again after many glasses of wine, but there was no food in Koshik's refrigerator, only a box of salted biscotti he had put between them, along with two glasses and a bottle of mineral water. He smoked a few cigarettes. She had her hands flat on the table, as if to derive heat from its surface, and he hooked one of his fingers, lightly but possessively, around the gold bangle on her wrist, causing her hand to shift slightly in his direction. "You wore this when you were a kid." It was a gift from her grandmother, something she'd had since she was 10. It was the only piece of jewelry she never bothered to remove. She'd always loved the design, small, four-petal flowers threaded along a vine, and when her wrist grew thick, she'd had the bangle cut off and enlarged. "You remember." "But you don't wear an engagement ring."
"I don't have one."
He studied the bangle, turning it slowly around.
"What kind of man proposes without a ring?"
She explained then that there had not been a proposal, that she hardly knew Naveen. She was looking away at a dried-out plant on the terrace, but she felt his eyes on her, intrigued, unafraid.
"Then why are you marrying him?"
She told him the truth, a truth she had not told anybody. "I thought it might fix things."
He did not question her further.
Unlike her friends back in America, who either thought she was doing something outrageously stupid or thrillingly bold, Koshik neither judged nor commended her. And the formal presentation of the facts, the declaration that she was taken, opened the door. Only his kisses, rough, aggressive kisses that were nothing like Naveen's schoolboy behavior at her door, made Hema feel guilty. But the rest of what they did that night felt fresh, new, because she and Naveen had never done them before, and there was nothing with which to compare. Naveen had never looked at her body unclothed, never explored her with his hands, never told her she was beautiful. Hema remembered that it was Koshik's mother who had first paid her that compliment, in a fitting room shopping for bras, and she told this to Koshik. It was the first mention between them of his mother, and yet it did not cause them to grow awkward. If anything, it bound them closer together, and Hema knew, without having to be told, that she was the first person he'd ever slept with who had known his mother, who was able to remember her as he did. His bare feet were warm, surprisingly smooth against her soles as they lay afterwards side by side. He slept on his back and at one point was startled awake by a nightmare, lunging forward and springing off the edge of the bed before falling asleep again. It was Hema who stayed awake, listening to him breathing, craving his touch again as light came into the sky. In the morning, looking into the small mirror over the sink in Koshik's bathroom, she saw that the area around her lips, at the sides of her mouth, were covered with small red bumps, and she was pleased by that unbecoming proof, pleased that already he had marked her. At first, Hema tried to stick to her morning routine at Giovanna's desk, but by 11 the phone would ring, and 20 minutes later she would be crossing the Ponte Garibaldi to meet him, or he would pull up to Giovanna's building in his Fiat to take her out for the day. And so she put away her books, lowered the screen of her laptop,
knowing she would not touch them again until she returned to Wellesley. At night he took her to out-of-the-way restaurants and bars, to fountains in abandoned squares where they sat like a teenaged couple, kissing. They went outside city walls to places she'd never been, and that he wanted to see for the last time. It was Kaushik who drove her to Ostia and Tivoli, and to Cevetri to visit the hilly tombs of the Etruscan necropolis. Hema told him about the history of those places, who had built them and why. She told him what she was learning about the Etruscans, that it was they who taught the Romans how to build their roads and irrigate their fields. She told him about the Etruscans' love of the natural world, their belief in signs and portents, their obsession with the journey out of life. They did not speak of their own future, of where their days together would lead. Nor did they discuss the past, the months during which he had lived in her home, the friendship between their parents that was already dying, along with his mother, during that time. Their parents had liked one another only for the sake of their origins, for the sake of a time and place to which they lost access. Hema had never been drawn to a person for that reason, until now. Almost always, an international news channel played without sound on the small television in Kaushik's apartment. His work depended wholly on the present, and on things yet to come. It was not the repeated resurrection of texts that had already been composed, of a time and people that had passed, and it made Hema aware of the sheltered quality not only of her life, but her mind. One day after she asked him to, he showed her his website. He left her alone to look at it, going out to buy food for their dinner. She sat on his bed, wrapped in a sheet, his laptop humming against her legs. There were countless images, terrible things she had read about in the newspaper and never had to think about again. Buses blasted apart by bombs, bodies on stretchers, young boys throwing stones. He had witnessed these things, unseen and uninvolved, yet with an immediacy she had never felt. Because he had become her lover, these images upset her. Kaushik had told her about fellow photographers who were killed on the job, about the time an Israeli police officer bashed his camera in his face. And she was secretly glad, as his mother would have been, that his work would soon be different, that he would be behind a desk in Hong Kong presiding over meetings, that he would not be constantly in harm's way. There were also shots of dusty streets and villages, markets and homes and shop windows, arid, barren landscapes, pictures of people. An old man sat peeling an orange under a tree, a flea-bitten dog dozing at his feet. A group of women in headscarves threw back their heads, laughing. A young girl poked her head out from behind a studded metal gate, bearing a gap-toothed smile. As she looked at the pictures, she began to appreciate his ability, perhaps his need, to connect to strangers in this way, and the willingness of strangers to connect to him. She began to understand his willingness, and she thought perhaps this was also a need, to disappear at any moment. He lived in a rented room with rented furniture, rented sheets and towels. In the corner, his camera bags and tripods were always packed, his passport always in his pocket. Apart from a detailed map of the West Bank, there was nothing on his walls. She suspected that even if it were possible to turn back the clock, to have never met Naveen and wait to bump into Kaushik in Rome, it would not have made a difference. She guessed that he had casually been with many women, that she should consider herself no different. And she refused to go to that miserable place Julian had dragged her to so many times, to hope for a thing that was unchangeable. The key turned in the lock, and then Kaushik was with her again. He set down the bags of food on a small square table set with two chairs, the only furniture, apart from the bed, in his apartment. For the first time he seemed hesitant in her presence, not kissing her first thing. He hung his coat on a hook, loosened the thin red wool scarf at his throat. "They're amazing," she said.
"They don't all pay the bills."
"Does it affect you, seeing these things?" He shrugged, opened the cupboard, took out two glasses for wine.
"It doesn't help anyone if I'm affected."
They stayed in that night, eating the bread and cheese he'd bought, the sliced meats and wine. Kaushik spent a while uploading images from his camera onto his website, writing captions. She helped him to pack stacks of contact sheets into boxes for the movers, gather up old photo magazines for the trash. He showed her a portfolio of pictures he hoped someday might form a book. For the first time they fell asleep without sex, not for lack of desire, but because the familiarity was growing. But then she felt him pressing up against her, felt his breath and his lips on the back of her neck, and she turned to face him, gave him her mouth. He could be aloof in bed, as he could be in general, focusing on some part of her body to the point of seeming to forget her. But that distance no longer threatened her. It was only in bed that he uttered her name, the hot word filling her ear. It was a Saturday night, lingering voices in the piazza giving way to silence, and at times the distant barking of dogs. "It does affect me," he said afterward as they lay in the dark, awake. "What?" "Taking pictures. Not always, but sometimes. Sometimes in ways I don't like." He lit a cigarette, and then he told her about a day last summer, when he was driving back from Fregene and passed an accident. Two cars had collided at an intersection. A crowd gathered, but the police had not yet arrived. Inside one of the cars, a child was crying. It turned out that the passengers were not badly hurt. Kaushik had pulled over, rushed out, but the first thing he'd done was take a picture. "The first thing," he told Hema, before even asking if they were okay. 3 weeks had passed. One evening in December, as they were returning to Giovanna's, Naveen called. The phone rang, and then Naveen left a message on the answering machine, calling to say hello, as Kaushik pressed Hema against the door and began unbuttoning her jacket, the top of her blouse, uncovering her breasts, and causing the keys to drop from her hands onto the terracotta floor. From the very beginning, she had felt clear-eyed, aware that in a matter of weeks it would end. In another 2 weeks, everything would be wiped clean. They would be in different countries. The keys to both Kaushik's and Giovanna's apartments in the hands of other people. And this knowledge allowed her once more to step out of her jeans as Naveen's voice spoke into the room. Even the fact that Kaushik had to wear a condom helped to keep him in his place, reminding her, whenever he paused to rip open the little packet, that in spite of what they were about to do, they would remain separate. Such thinking was a consequence of Julian, she knew. She supposed that all those years of loving a person who was dishonest had taught her a few things. She told Naveen that she was going to travel during her last week in Italy, another lie to prevent him from contacting her again, and this gave Hema and Kaushik the idea to take a trip together. They decided to go north, to Volterra, a town founded by Etruscans, and it was in that austere, forbidding, solitary place that they spent their remaining days together. They went in Kaushik's car up the coast into Tuscany, then cutting through the misted blue Maremma and the white chalk hills of Cecina Valley, climbing and descending a thin slip of road. Volterra appeared in the distance, perched on a cliff high above the open countryside, like an island surrounded by land. The rough, restrained architecture, the coats of arms, and the hard, dark walls were something new for Hema. The medieval buildings were more recent than the Forum, yet Volterra felt more remote, impervious to tourists and time. Rome had hidden them, enabled them, their affair one of thousands, but here, she felt singled out, exposed. She also sensed an indifference. They were among a handful of people who seemed not to belong to Volterra, and she felt that the people who lived there were waiting for them, politely but firmly, to pass on. It was a nearly silent place, apart from the sharp sound of their footsteps, the insistent coupled notes of the bells, the shriek of the wind. At that great height, the wind was constant, striking their faces and agitating their hair. It was the week before Christmas, the town discreetly decorated, holly draped over the antipasti tables in restaurants. They went into the workshops where alabaster was cut and polished, the translucent material quarried in Volterra for thousands of years. It was colder than Rome, a cold that emanated from stone, and instead of her leather jacket, Hema now wore a peacoat of Kaushik's, grateful for the weight over her shoulders, remembering that other coat of Kaushik's she'd so hated wearing when she was a girl, back when they were nothing, but already something to each other. They stayed in a hotel that had once been a convent, slept in the former quarters of nuns. The food was plainer, bowls of ribollita, bread without salt, bittersweet hot chocolate in the afternoons. As they ate their meals and rested their feet from walking, they too felt fortified, tranquil, much like the town. Kaushik took a few photographs, not many, never of Hema, less of the town itself than the spectacular views it provided. The Carrara Mountains to the north, and the Ligurian Sea distantly gleaming, one cloudless afternoon 30 miles to the west. They looked down at the ruins of a Roman amphitheater, and over the walls at the Balse, a precipice beneath which the earth had fallen away, once claiming a church, always threatening to take more of the town. Beneath the Porta all'Arco, the Etruscan gateway, three featureless blackened heads gazed down like sentinels upon them, and upon the world they had left behind. Mainly because it was cold, they took refuge in the churches and museums. They saved the Guarnacci Etruscan Museum for last, and there they saw, lined on shelves, hundreds of urns in which the ancient people of Volterra had stored the ashes of their dead. They were called urns, but were more like little caskets, made of alabaster or terracotta, the lids topped with figures with large heads and disproportionately small bodies, grotesquely but indisputably alive. The women were veiled, held fans or pomegranates in their hands. The sides were covered with carvings showing so many migrations across land and departures in covered wagons to the underworld, so many fantastic beasts and fish-tailed gods of the sea. Hema and Kaushik were the only visitors to the museum that day, alone apart from the heat that hissed from the radiators, the guards sitting patiently in their folding chairs. In the museum there was another sarcophagus of a husband and wife, but they were nothing like the languid, loving pair Hema had seen in Rome. Here they were older, cruder, still bristling after years of marriage, ill at ease. After the museum they went to lunch, in a restaurant on Piazza dei Priori they had already tried and liked. After eating they would drive back to Rome, and the following day Hema would fly to India. They had checked out of the hotel that morning, their bags already in the car. The padrone seated them at the table in the corner where they had sat before. They ordered bruschetta with black cabbage, soft pappardelle flecked with wild boar. Hema looked at the postcard she had bought at the museum, lining them up on the table as they drank the first glass of wine. One thing they'd seen there had been unlike anything else. A bronze sculpture of a severely elongated boy's body, a skeleton more than flesh, standing with his arms at his sides. At the center of the restaurant, at a long messy table, a slightly raucous group was gathered, mostly men in their 30s wearing suits. An office holiday party, Kaushik explained, after listening for a while to the conversation. They work in the bank. He continued listening, then said, "They've lived here in each other's company all their lives. They will die here." "I envy them that," Hema said. "Do you?" "I've never belonged to any place that way." Kaushik laughed. "You're complaining to the wrong person." "What if you hate Hong Kong? Where will you go?" "I don't know." "Will you come back to Italy?" "No." "Why not?" He poured more wine into her glass than his. He leaned forward slightly, looking at her, then seeming to change his mind about what he wanted to say. "I've reached an end here, that's all." The meal ended without conversation, with vin santo and a slice of chestnut cake. They stepped outside, into the first twilight, for a last look at the town. It was the hour of the passeggiata, the older people promenading arm in arm through the streets. The men were with men, women with women, segregated as Hema and Kaushik's parents once tended to be at parties. There was a uniformity to their appearances, their faces and their clothing, the flat woolen caps on the men's heads, the straight skirts and low-heeled black and navy blue shoes of the women. With them, alongside them, were children and grandchildren, the generations knit casually and fondly together. "Come with me," Kaushik said. "Where?" "To Hong Kong." And then he said, "Don't marry him, Hema." She stopped walking. They were on a street of steps, lined with cypress trees, working their way down. Those behind her in the collective procession murmured, "Permesso," and pressed past. She felt the lurch of a head rush. The boy who had not paid attention to her, the man who'd embarked on an affair knowing she could never be his. At the last moment he was asking for more. A piece of her was elated, but she was also struck by his selfishness, by the fact that he was telling her what to do. Unlike Naveen, he was not offering to come to her. "Don't answer now," he said, pulling her toward him, guiding her down a few more steps, his arm around her waist. "Go to India first, straighten things out, I can wait." She moved away, upset for the first time by his touch.
It's too late, Kaushik.
He extended a finger toward her jaw, turned her gently to look at him, into the tired eyes she had begun to love. His face glowed with affection for her, with hope, and she knew then that it was not just the wine talking, that he meant what he'd said. In a few weeks it will be, not yet. He sought her hand again, and they continued walking. They entered a small piazza where she was aware everywhere of children, boys and girls of 5 and 7, 8 and 10, swarming around them as if a school had just been dismissed. She had known Kaushik at that age. She had worn his coat, given him her bed, dreamed of him kissing her, these facts of the past haunting her and steadying her at the same time. The Italian children, eager for Christmas's approach, calling out "Buon Natale" as they greeted one another, were embracing in the cold air, their youthful excitement infectious and pure, so much so that Hema's heart leapt with theirs. In 10 years, she imagined, these boys and girls would begin to fall in love with one another. In another 5, their own children would be at their feet. On the drive down from Volterra, as the landscape disappeared and they traveled through the night, she told him. She explained her reasons, reasons that had nothing to do with Naveen. She told Kaushik she was not able to give up her life, not able to follow him that way, and that she didn't expect it of him. She said she didn't want to try to change him, didn't want to be accused one day of pinning him down. "It doesn't mean we can't continue to see each other," she said, afraid to suggest it, more afraid not to. "I'm not interested in any sort of arrangement," he said, in the cold tone she had not heard since they were teenagers. It was the only thing he said during the drive, until he pulled up in front of Giovanna's apartment in the middle of the night. Then he said, "You're a coward." She began to cry, unable to control herself, aware that he would never forgive her for refusing him, that even if she were to change her mind, he had already retracted his invitation. He had told her not to marry Naveen, but he had not asked her to marry him, and Hema knew that it was not a fair trade. As she cried, he sat there, unmoved, as he must have been when he took his pictures, as he'd been that morning when she was 13 and he had uncovered graves in the snow. She realized he had nothing more to say, that he was only waiting for her to get out of the car. They spent the night apart, and she did not expect to see him again. But the next morning he called to make sure she was packed, told her that he'd be there in an hour. He drove her to Fiumicino and accompanied her to check in, speaking Italian on her behalf. He walked her over to security, kissed her lightly on the mouth, and then he was gone, leaving her to wipe her tears, to take off her shoes and empty her pockets of the pretty coins that would soon buy her nothing. She navigated her way to the gate, riding an air train. She sat by a window with a view of Alitalia jets crisscrossing slowly on the tarmac, watching other passengers, mostly Indians, fill up the seats. She sat alone, flipping through Italian fashion magazines until the flight was called. It wasn't until she was on the ramp leading to the plane that she realized what she'd left behind. Her bangle, the one she never removed, the one Kaushik had hooked his finger through that first night, drawing her to him. She saw it now in her mind, sitting in the gray plastic tray she'd placed it in before passing through the security gate. She turned around, began walking in the opposite direction, back to the woman who had taken her boarding pass. "Everyone is being seated now. The plane is about to take off." "I've left something behind," Hema said. "Jewelry." The woman looked at her, vaguely interested. "What type of jewels?" "A bangle," she said. A hand went to her naked wrist. "You would like us to check where you have been sitting?" "No." She remembered the ride on the air train, all the shops along the way. "It's at security. I went through this morning." The woman shook her head, the whole time she was doing her job taking boarding passes from the other people. "There is no way to reach security now. If you like, we send a message." She went back down the ramp, onto the plane, and found her seat. She fastened her seatbelt, her right arm feeling foreign, missing the sound the bangle would have made coming into contact with the metal buckle. It would be replaced tenfold in the course of her wedding, and yet she felt she had left a piece of her body behind. She had grown up hearing from her mother that losing gold was inauspicious, and as the plane began to climb, in those moments she was still aware of it moving. A dark thought passed through her. that it would crash or be blasted apart in the sky. Then the fear turned numb. Already on the screen at the center of the plane, there was a map with a white line emerging away from Rome, creeping toward India, and this simple graphic composed her, making clear the only road available now.
He was in a place where he knew no one. He was staying at a small resort a little north of Khao Lak, in a one-room thatched bungalow on stilts. This was his third day on the beach, and already he felt drugged by the routine. Getting out of bed, eating fruit and sticky rolls for breakfast, lying in his swimming trunks on the hot sand. He glanced at back issues of the magazine where he was about to work, but mainly, he dozed. He had stopped shaving, an uneven beard beginning to form on his face. The food reminded him a little of his childhood, steaming rice, dense brown and yellow curries, whole red and green chilies floating in sauce. Normally, he harbored no nostalgia for the particular elements of his upbringing, adapting to so many cuisines throughout his adult life. But this food caused him to feel strangely sentimental. His eye distracted him, the shifting speck visible whenever he happened to remove his sunglasses and confront the untempered brightness of the day. The beach faced west, and each evening he ordered a beer and watched the sunset over the water. The water was calm and shallow, but he preferred swimming in the pool. There had been an occasion off the coast of Venezuela many years ago, when the undertow caused him a genuine struggle. A neighboring bather lent a hand, but since then, he had not swum in the ocean, no longer trusting it, knowing that his mother, who loved water so much that she would have swum in a pool of algae, would have scoffed. Behind the beach, rubber trees rose thickly on the hills. Somewhere across the water, beyond the Andaman Sea, was the Bay of Bengal and Calcutta, where Hema was. On the plane from Italy, his anger had dissolved, and now in Thailand he was left only with longing for her. He wondered if he should have brought things up earlier, wondered if he had sounded half-hearted. He regretted his surliness when she had refused. She was the only person he'd met in his adult life who had any understanding of his past, the only woman he wanted to remain connected to. He didn't want to leave it up to chance to find her again. He didn't want to share her with another man. That last day in Volterra, he had searched for a way to tell her these things. She had not accused him, as Franca had, of his own cowardice, of his inability to form attachments. But Hema's refusal to accuse him made him feel worse, and without her, he was lost. There was a Swedish family in the neighboring bungalow, with a boy and a girl who both sunbathed and swam in their underpants as if they had forgotten to pack their swimsuits. The children were tall for their ages. He was startled to learn, overhearing the mother tell one of the women who served drinks at the resort, that they were only 5 and 7. The mother was attractive, with a lean, freckled face and closely cropped hair, and seemed to wear a new bathing suit every few hours. In the mornings, she would sit at their little round table in front of the bungalow, peeling fruit, offering pieces of coconut and papaya to the children, wearing a thin robe that was the color of a watermelon's flesh. While the children played and chased each other on the sand, she sat in a chair and read, swatting them affectionately with a magazine when they attempted to involve her in their games. The woman and her husband made an incongruous couple. The husband was a large man, his skin burnt, straw-blonde hair to his shoulders, hair longer than his wife's, a face like a ham. He spent most of the days sleeping in a hammock strung up between two trees, straining the knots that held him. As far as Kaushik could tell, it was just himself and the Swedish family. The third bungalow at this end of the resort, down a path from the main hotel building, was empty. He'd thought about moving around a bit, going down to Phuket after Christmas, but for now, he wasn't inspired to go anywhere else. He'd taken a few pictures of the view from his bungalow, long-tail boats on the water, the Swedish children playing on the sand. He felt no inclination to go walking through the hillside to photograph the shrines or to take a boat to the Similan Islands. In 3 days, he left the resort only once, walking to a strip of souvenir and dive shops that bored him. He found an internet center, considered going inside to see if Hema had written. Then he remembered that he had not given her his email address. Instead, he uploaded new pictures onto his website of Volterra, where Hema had been standing pressed up next to him, her hair flapping in the wind, strands of it sometimes intruding in front of the lens, and a few pictures of the Andaman Sea. He spent Christmas on the beach as he had every other day. The restaurant at the resort had put up a small fake tree. He had dinner on the patio as a full moon poured its shimmering light across the water. The Swedish family occupied the neighboring table, conversing, laughing, eating their meal. The children's long limbs were dark from the sun. The family had ordered an array of dishes, were messily picking at a whole curried fish. Kaushik thought of Hema, and anger coursed through him, thinking of her about to enter the world of marriage, of children, of taking trips and sleeping for the rest of her life with someone she did not love. The wife stood up when they finished, kissed the husband on the forehead, and took the children away. "Join me for a drink," the man called out to Kaushik after they'd gone. They walked indoors into the air-conditioned bar and ordered whiskey. A band was setting up to play. The Swedish man, Henrik, worked as a film editor for a television station in Stockholm. They spoke about the press in Sweden and Italy, about the war in Iraq.
"Our jobs, they are similar," Henrik said.
"Our names, too." Kaushik nodded. It was the fourth Christmas the family had spent at this resort, Henrik said. The first year, Lars was just a baby.
"Your families don't mind?"
"What?
You're going to Thailand for Christmas."
"My wife's parents complain, but we come anyway. They are in Stockholm, living across the street. My parents are divorced, both remarried."
Henrik shook his big head.
"Too many people to see. And you, where is your family?"
"My mother's dead, my father lives in the United States."
"But you are Indian, no?"
"Yes."
"You live in India?"
"I don't live anywhere at the moment. I'm about to move to Hong Kong."
"Married?" Henrik asked.
He shook his head.
"But you are thinking of someone. My wife says so. Missing her."
He had not thought that he had been obvious, that the family had been paying attention to him. He thought about denying it.
"Now and again."
"You will see her soon?"
"No."
Henrik shrugged.
"Alone is good, too."
He drained his whiskey. Kaushik's mood darkened. As much as he'd wanted Hema to be with him now, he knew it would be easier to begin life in Hong Kong alone. He knew there was nothing for her to do there, that the move would have stripped her of her work, her world. The band started to play, the stale cover music grating. He wanted to be alone, to lie down and think.
"I'm going to bed," he said.
"Good night," Henrik told him.
He ordered another whiskey.
"One last for me."
Once more, the day was flawless. Kaushik got up, walked over to the restaurant for breakfast. Henrik was sitting at the bar where Kaushik had left him the night before, but he was freshly showered, dressed in swimming trunks and a Hawaiian shirt, drinking coffee, breaking apart his rolls.
"You felt your bed shake this morning?"
Kaushik shook his head.
"They said in the hotel a small earthquake,"
Henrik said.
"Over now."
Whatever had happened, Kaushik had slept through it. He thought back to the day in El Salvador when he'd taken his first real picture, and the tremor that had come just before, the stew spilling from its bowls, the young man in impeccably clean tan trousers lying in a pool of blood on the street.
"There is a shallow coral reef not far from here. Like to come? My wife and the kids want to buy things in town."
Kaushik looked out at the water. "I'm not a very good swimmer." Henrik laughed.
"Someone else will be doing the swimming for us."
He pointed to a fishing boat resting on the shoreline.
"I've arranged for a good price. When we get there, you can relax while I poke around."
After breakfast, they walked over to the boat. The owner, a bare-chested teenage Thai boy wearing long red shorts, was clearing it of leaves and withered frangipani petals. Two small lime-colored frogs hopped out, leaping onto the sand. Henrik scooped up one in each of his large hands and brought them over to his children, who began chasing the frogs around in circles, their heads bent toward the ground. The Thai boy began to pull the boat into the water, Kaushik following, white foam like soap suds hissing around his ankles. He had brought one of his cameras, wearing it around his neck. Henrik had an extra set of snorkeling gear in case Kaushik changed his mind. They got into the boat, the boy taking his place at the front. On the beach, Henrik's wife raised a thin arm from where she was sitting, gave a lazy wave. The children looked up briefly as Henrik and Kaushik settled themselves inside. There was plenty of room on board, and when Henrik called out to his wife and said something in Swedish, pointing to the empty seats, Kaushik guessed that it was to ask her and the children to join them. But she replied in the negative, shaking her head and retreating behind one of her magazines. He experienced a moment's nervousness because Henrik was so large, but the boat absorbed their shared weight. The Thai boy lifted his oar, and they began to move. Kaushik felt the swell of the sea beneath the hull close to his body, not touching him, but penetrating him at the same time. The resort retreated from view, the bungalows beneath the palms, and the darting forms of Henrik's children turning to specks, the familiar coastline curving away like a flat, smiling beast. The boy spoke a little English, told Henrik about the school of parrotfish he'd seen the day before. The morning sun was already strong, and after a while, Henrik took off his shirt. Kaushik looked at Henrik's broad pink back, glistening with sweat. They were skirting an abandoned cove.
"It's getting hot," Henrik said.
He tapped the boy on the shoulder.
"I take a dip here to cool off."
The boy nodded, rested his oar. Henrik dived over the edge of the boat and started to swim, his ungainly body turning graceful as it cut through the water with swift, skillful strokes. And alongside Henrik, for a moment, Kaushik saw his mother also swimming, saw her body still vital, a brief blur that passed as effortlessly as the iridescent fish darting from time to time beneath the boat. His torso cast a shadow into the sea. He thought of the thin bronze sculpture of the boy he'd seen with Hema and Volterra, in the Etruscan Museum. It was called L'Ombra della Sera, the Shadow of Evening. But in Khao Lak, it was the morning, the sun burning down on Kaushik, his shadow still in proportion to his body. When he looked up, he saw that the boy had guided them close to shore. Henrik emerged from the water, waded clumsily towards the deserted cove. The white sand was spotless, limestone cliffs looming behind. Kaushik lifted the camera to his face, took a picture, and set the camera down at his feet. He dipped his hands into the water, cooling off his face and neck, not expecting its salty taste. Then he unbuttoned his shirt, felt the sun strike his skin. He wanted to swim to the cove as Henrik had, to show his mother he was not afraid. He took off his sunglasses, leaving them in the boat next to his camera. The speck in his vision rose and fell, erasing its random trail. He held on to the edge of the boat, swinging his legs over the side, lowering himself. The sea was as warm and as welcoming as a bath. His feet touched the bottom, and so he let go.
All day I was oblivious. I was out with my mother and two aunts being fitted for blouses, selecting jewels. We had spent hours on a thin futon drinking cokes and eating mutton rolls, as men in a sari shop unfolded the greater part of their inventory. I went along with all of it, chose a red Benarasi to wear. But the whole time I was thinking of you, fearful of the mistake I was making. I was still slightly jet-lagged, hungry for meals we were used to eating together, for the taste of good coffee and wine. On the crowded street, walking back to my parents' flat off Triangular Park, I searched foolishly for your face. "A terrible thing has happened," the gatekeeper told us when we arrived. On television, in a pink sitting room with stark fluorescent light, I saw images of the Indian and Sri Lankan coastline, glimpses from vacationers' video cameras, never intended to capture such a thing. I saw a massive surge of water moving so quickly that the tape seemed to be playing at an unnatural speed. At first, it was only the damage in South India and Sri Lanka I was aware of, the fishing villages that had been obliterated, tourists stranded on Vivekananda's rock. And then I learned that Thailand had also been hit very badly. I did not know where you were in Thailand, only that you planned to be on a beach. I had not asked you the details, thinking, as I prepared to leave you, that such information would make it worse. The next morning I went to the newsstand and bought the papers, studying every picture, looking for your name in one of the credits, hoping you had been lucky and that you had continued to do your work. I went to an internet center, drew up your website. I saw the last images you had posted, a faint sliver of the shoreline we had seen from Volterra, three blackened faces, supposed to be Etruscan divinities, that loomed over our heads, and then, scenes of another coast, two children playing, a gentle turquoise sea. At the end of that week, Naveen arrived to marry me. I was repulsed by the sight of him, not because I had betrayed him, but because he still breathed, because he was there for me, and had countless more days to live. And yet, without his even realizing it, firmly but without force, Naveen pulled me away from you, as the final gust of autumn wind pulls the last leaves from the trees. We were married. We were blessed. My hand was placed on top of his, and the ends of our clothing were knotted together. I felt the weight of each ritual, felt the ground once more underfoot. Our honeymoon in Goa was cancelled. Naveen said that it didn't seem right to swim in the polluted waters that surrounded India at the time. I returned to my existence, the existence I had chosen instead of you. It was another winter in Massachusetts, 30 years after you and your parents had first gone away. In February, Giovanna got in touch to say she had heard the news from Paola. A small obituary ran in the New York Times. By then I needed no proof of your absence from the world. I felt it as plainly and implacably as the cells that were gathering and shaping themselves in my body. Those cold, dark days I spent in bed, unable to speak, burning with new life but mourning your death, went unquestioned by Naveen, who had already begun to take a quiet pride in my condition. My mother, who called often from India to check on me, had heard too. "Remember the Chowdhuries, the family that once stayed with us?" she began. It might have been your child, but this was not the case. We had been careful, and you had left nothing behind. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Unaccustomed Earth by Jhumpa Lahiri. This program was directed by Scott Cresswell. Executive producer, Aurelie Moskowitz. This program was edited at John Marshall Sound. Text copyright 2008 by Jhumpa Lahiri. Production copyright 2008, Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.